You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome. I'm Anthony Richter, Associate Director of OSI and Director of the Central Eurasia Project. I'm very pleased to welcome you today to this discussion of the question of labor migration in the Russian Federation. The idea of doing this forum was to help get the word out about a new Human Rights Watch report, new as of February, called Are You Happy to Cheat Us? Exploitation of Migrant Construction Workers in Russia. And we thought that we would cast the net a little wider by looking at the Russian economy and the current economic crisis, and also at some of the impacts on Central Asia itself. And so we have a very good panel. Let me briefly introduce our three speakers and then turn the floor over to them. Professor Richard Erickson is the chairman of the economics department at East Carolina University. And for many years, when I was back at Columbia, he was a professor of economics at the Harriman Institute and was director of the Harriman Institute here in New York. And we're tremendously glad that he's able to join us today. Rachel Denber is the deputy director of the Europe and Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch and was responsible for overseeing the research that is being presented today. And it's part of a larger project, which you may mention, that they're undertaking over a period of 2 years. And then finally, last but not least, Michael Hall, our own regional director for the Caucasus and Central Asia. Rick Erickson is going to lay the background for the discussion by providing information about how Russia slid into the current crisis and what it's and why this is important for labor migrants. Rachel is going to present the findings of her report, and Michael is going to make the to look at Tajikistan, and the whole question of remittances. So, without further ado, Rick, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I apologize for the presentation. It's going to be kind of small and hard to read, but it's a technical. You can see the outline of what I want to say in case I have trouble getting through all of it along that sidebar. What I want to begin with is looking at the nature of the crisis, how it played out in Russia and particularly in the mind of the Russian leadership and what they did about it. And as you can see, there is a three-stage response to this date, the third stage actually being fairly realistic. The crisis began, as everybody knows, with massive new wealth being created in the last decade and a half that was searching for safe and liquid assets. And U.S. Securities, and at that point it appeared the private securities, were among the safest and most secure assets. So wealth just flowed into there, facilitated by the Federal Reserve System. That drove a financial budget, which led to high and increasing asset values, stimulating further transfers of wealth from abroad, which burst when it became obvious, well, following about 8 months after the beginnings of the subprime crisis in the U.S., when it became clear that these assets were not going to be paying what everybody had hoped they would be paying. When that financial bubble actually burst, it generated a massive shift of wealth out of financial assets, accelerating the decline in world financial markets, and into real assets. And we saw in the first half of 2008 an explosion in prices of physical commodities, the metals, energy carriers, and even food, leading to food riots in a number of places in the world. That increase in prices of fundamental inputs further undercut the operation of most of the economies of the world, leading to a deterioration in fundamentals reflected in financial assets as well as in real GDP growth, and burst forth as a worldwide recession in the second half of 2008, which collapsed not only the financial bubble fully, but also the resource price bubble. And the poster child for that is oil from over $147 down to the vicinity of $30 for a brief period. This crisis hit a very successful and confident Russia when it finally hit. And indeed, they didn't really see it coming initially and benefited in the very first stages of it because Russia looked like a rapidly appreciating asset in some sense. GDP had been growing at Asian tiger rates. Investment was up dramatically. Consumption was up. You can see the various figures there. The ruble had been appreciating ever since 2004, 2005. At one point got as low as 23 to a dollar. And foreign exchange reserves were the third largest in the world, supported by huge budget surpluses, or supporting those indeed. Capital flight that had been the sign of the 1990s and the early collapse of the Soviet economy had turned into massive foreign investment. You can see there are $84 billion worth of FDI coming in, FDI and portfolio investment, coming into Russia in 2007. And they were able to build a stabilization fund, which at the beginning of 2008, they split into two funds, a reserve fund to protect against just such a crisis as is hitting now, collapse of oil prices, and a welfare fund to support the various national development projects that Putin had had developed. State debt, which had been the bane of Yeltsin's Russia, was incredibly low, only about $40 billion, only one and a half of it to governments, a tribute to Putin's effort to make Russia financially independent of the IFIs and the Western countries that he sort of deeply felt did not have Russia's best interests in mind. And they had what looked like a very secure source of income in their exports of natural resources. Okay, that growth accelerated through the first quarter of 2008. And indeed, both the World Bank and EBRD were talking about the Russian economy overheating. The big threat is going to be inflation. And it did sort of look like that. But by June, there were some endogenous problems that had appeared. Inflation was up, as with the overheating scenario, but output suddenly dropped in its rate of increase. It wasn't going negative, but still, the economy was still growing. But it was not anywhere near the pace of the last three, 4 years. And more of a dangerous signal, investment dropped dramatically. This was aggravated by what appeared to be various attacks on property rights in Russia. Putin's famous statement about Michel and gouging inside Russia and the accusations of price fixing by other resource companies whose prices abroad were being driven by this resource bubble, and they were mostly under fairly long-term contracts domestically, which were holding those prices down. That was capped by an investor flight, Western investor flight, that came along with the war in Georgia. Suddenly Russia, following these political questionings of property rights, didn't look like such a safe haven. And so you had, in the month of August, $50 billion turning around and running out of the country. You remember the 90s, the panic was over the fact that about $15 billion every year left Russia for a decade. So now we're seeing swings that are on both sides dramatically greater than that. Okay, now that crisis, that sort of marked the pre-stage of the crisis, which hit Russia then in later August and into September. Both the RTS and MIKEX indices dropped dramatically. Indeed, the Russian equity markets suffered the worst collapse of any in the world, cumulatively running up to almost 80% before they started a rebound a couple of months later. Foreign capital was departing. There were margin calls on Russian debt, which means that the assets of the oligarchs, who, as we will see, had borrowed incredibly heavily. Russia's overall debt position had become much deeper in this period of fabulous growth. It's just that it was no longer state debt trying to keep the society and economy together. It was private debt that was being used largely for acquisitions, frequently foreign acquisitions. Everything was bought on margin, and when things go sour, when suddenly you have to come up with wealth and assets and nobody's willing to roll over your own loans because of the liquidity crisis across the world, you suddenly face the prospect of having to give up your assets. that was exacerbated by what was not really recognized at the time, the collapse of the real resource bubble, which drove down dramatically the prices that the Russians were getting with their massive exports. That generated financial collapse in the markets. You can see a bunch of the indicators there that I've already mentioned a few words on. But most significantly, export earnings drove up. In fact, it's sort of interesting, if you watch MICEX and it's down 80% drop, and you do it day by day, a correlation, it's 97.35% with the price of oil's daily drops. So people were watching Russian wealth evaporate and pulling out of the market commensurately. You can see Urals oil, which never got to the West Texas sweet and light level, was up at 137 in July. It was down to 49.30 in November, and it had a long way to go still. Steel dropped to a quarter of its price in June. You had a drop of over 50% in nickel, zinc, copper, aluminum, everything that made Russia a major player in the world economy. Now, that begins to look like, when you just look at the financial sectors, the crisis of 1998. There's a lot of capital flight, and equities are falling through the floor. However, there were some substantial differences, not all of them working in Russia's favor, but most of them doing so. They had a functioning market system. It's a very particular kind, and I want to explore that in one slide in just a bit. But it was a functioning market system, something one could not really claim 97-98. Markets were highly flexible, albeit segmented. Indeed, the labor market was very flexible, and some of the fallout of that flexibility is going to come out later. They were internationally integrated in capital markets, indeed very heavily and deeply integrated, which wasn't all an advantage. And by 2007, growth was suddenly endogenizing in a way that did not depend on the price of oil. If one looks at the statistical analysis from the beginning of the 2000s up to 2007, virtually all growth came from the energy sectors, from oil and natural gas. By 2007, you see a shift in the drivers of growth. They were becoming consumer durable services. Housing was becoming a major part of it, construction industry. All being generated by the spending of those in the leading sectors that were earning all this money abroad. And you saw by 2007 into the first half of 2008 actually noticeable increases in productivity of labor, not just attracting resources in, as had been the case in most of this decade since the prior crisis. However, it's worth noting that markets both mitigate and propagate shocks. And indeed, the financial and the real economies were very tightly integrated in 2008. Back in 1997, 1998, there was virtually no connection. So a total financial collapse of Yeltsin's Russia really didn't do anything to the real economy that was as much virtual as anything else in its operation on the basis of barter and personalized deals and so on. Now economic activity is fully monetized. It's supported by credit, credit that can be called, credit that needs to be rolled over. There had been substantial foreign borrowing for business expansion. You can see the numbers at the bottom of this page. It was up to $391 billion in corporate debt. Financial institutions had a substantial portion of it. It was accelerating through the first half of 2008. There's another $39 billion in syndicated loans taken by Russian companies. Furthermore, you had flexibility in the limited small and medium enterprise sector. Even though this was outside of the sectors that the government, the state, really had a deep interest in, largely in trade and services, but still one-third of registered businesses employed about a quarter of the workforce, including a huge portion of that migrant labor that was there, and produced about one-fifth of GDP, which is not far from European standards. If you think back to 97, 98, it was a minuscule fraction of European standards in the registered, at least, small and medium industry sector. We also had a difference in that here, in 97, 98, the government just pulled the plug on finances, defaulted on everything, fourfold devaluation of the ruble, and said, let it drop where it may. Here, as we will see, there was a very strong and sustained government response. But it was in an economy I've already characterized as market, but one which I would like to claim is a politically constrained market system. And a couple of the key characteristics, and we can go into this in a lot more detail and discussion if you're interested, are that markets are active instruments for implementation, for getting things done, for coordination. It's what they do best. Goals, however, in Putin's Russia have to be authorized. Economic activity, first and foremost, must be in the interests of the state, and that's what legitimates private gain. Deripaska is the famous statement that if the state asks for it back, I will give it all, and I don't need compensation. Major business, in fact, in some sense, he's already given about 80% of it, over 80% of it in the last 6 months. Major business developments require official approval. You try to build an LNG port up by Murmansk without the approval, a pipeline to China, you can end up doing life in Siberia, as Hodorkovsky found out. Furthermore, economic activity, the what needs to be done, where's the economy going, is controlled from what I still like to think of as commanding heights in the Leninist sense, but now they are financial. The Russian government, Russian economists know enough economics that you cannot micromanage physically. You cannot plan and run anything effectively the size of a national economy. However, they are still under the illusion, perhaps, that one can organize it like Russia Incorporated, with profit centers and cost centers and everything managed financially. The key instruments for that are the five main state banks that are listed there. There are a number of national champion groups, tightly politically connected, often with Putin allies and former KGB colleagues in one of the top three positions. I have a number of those listed there. And the fact that management of these things, key decisions are made in close consultation with the political authorities. It was very clear under Putin, it's a little less so under Medvedev, but you have all of these leaders of these major groups regularly отчитывая перед начальством, showing up and ending up on the presidential page website with their discussions about how their business is going, what are their plans, what are you going to do about this pipeline or this track to China, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a sort of free market system in the sense that Great Britain or Sweden have, but it is very much a market system. Okay, so how did the Russians respond to the crisis that hit this particular system? There are three stages. This is the outline. I'll say a little bit more about each of them in a second, but basically it started from that's all the Americans' fault. It's their problem. Let them deal with it, not our problem. However, things went very rapidly from bad to worse in Russia. That led to a very strong reaction, sort of the biggest TARP-like rescue in the world in terms of the size of the economy, to protect the ruble and Russian assets in particular. It was not aimed at supporting employment or standards of living, however. Massive financial intervention, we'll look at that in detail. And then in March, early March, it was recognized that this wasn't doing enough and that we have to get realistic about this. We can't sort of block all foreign acquisitions of assets. We can't protect all the oligarchs. And so they hunkered down for a longer-term effort to respond to the crisis. Okay, so what was the initial response? This it's not our problem thing. It was obvious denial. There's some real classic quotes. At the beginning, they did launch a very strong and expensive defense of the ruble, something that Putin considers one of his major achievements in securing independence from the IFIs and the Western majors, is the fact that the ruble is now a very strong currency. He's been pushing for a while the idea this should become a reserve currency, although that's faded in the last 5 months. Russia was a safe haven, and indeed should take advantage of the crisis. As Dvorakovich said, the state's willing to help you acquire foreign assets if they're worthwhile at bargain basement prices. So despite facing growing credit constraints, which were exacerbated by the collapsing resource prices, and they didn't really realize how far they were collapsing at this point, the economy proceeded to go from bad to worse. This response proved inadequate. Major industrial groups were unable to refinance their borrowings. Earnings and credit shocks propagated throughout the economy. Major industrial producers went from growth to drop in income, so that looking on what had been almost 9% growth through the first half was suddenly 1.6% when you get to the end of the third quarter. December industrial production actually went negative. The lack of commercial credit hit small business and unprotected things, new startups, very, very heavily. And part of the defense of the ruble involved really jacking up borrowing rates, which froze out unprotected industries. So you see a wave of small business and entrepreneurial closings, some of which were even noted in the New York Times and human interest stories. And there was a collapse of state revenues. The Russian budget, which had not run a deficit since before 99, actually, was suddenly facing a real deficit, and that was recognized. Okay, so that led to the second stage of the response. This is a crisis. We want to do something. What do we want to do? Well, here we have a very characteristic, I would say, Russian response. What you are going to do is shore up your sovereignty. Keep your assets to yourself. They had already been driving foreigners out of assets which were not, which were considered critical to the importance of the state. So they didn't want to have that undone. You want to maintain the ability of the government to manage this economy through its financial instruments and defend the strong ruble. So there were three stages of actual physical actions, mostly by the central bank and the finance ministry. I don't have them on here, but time is short. That involved trying to shore up liquidity and support the ruble. Finally, in mid-October, we saw the beginnings of the detailed response at this stage, which was put into law on November 10th, after being formally published on November 7th, as sort of the Putin plan for recovery. And it's worth emphasizing that this was indeed deeper and more extensive than anywhere else. They established clear sectoral priorities, and they're the usual suspects, as you can see. Credit was to be state-directed and micromanaged. You don't get a bailout without them telling you how to use it. It made TARP restrictions look loose. There was a redoing of a budget. The initial budget had said that, hey, we're going to have massive growth. We're going to have oil at $90 a barrel, $85 a barrel. We're going to have a strong ruble down in the mid-20s. Now they're recognizing that's indefensible. So you can see the key parameters of the budget. It's only going to avoid running a deficit because there's $72 billion that can be taken out of the former stabilization funds. And a critical part of it was to reintroduce the idea of gosszakazi on large scale. This involves placing orders for output to the critical industries, and a new twist, which Gorbachev didn't even think through too, is to offer not only lower prices, but to pay 70-80% of it in advance so that these companies would not need any credit, wouldn't have to go to the now frozen financial system to be able to keep operating and fulfilling their obligations to the state. They also reduced the export tariffs on energy products, dropped $7 billion into the stock market, which was part of what helped reverse it from that 80% drop in value. $62 billion was given to Vnesheknombank to support business capital, refinance foreign debt, direct subsidy to those five key banks. Some of it was supposed to be channeled into the commercial banks. They provided credits for the subsidy for the key banks. And temporary deposits in commercial banks in an attempt to sort of keep the system from freezing up, keep things operating. And it also had a little mortgage support because the construction industry was being hit hard by the collapse of ability to pay. Indeed, that was more important than in many other places because Russians tend to pay up front. They're required to for their construction. So you've sunk your money. You have a house on order, or an apartment on order, and suddenly the construction company has no liquidity and they stop working on it, but they've already got all your money. So you need to find, they need to find some way to keep working to fulfill that contract. You can see the full size of it here. It was almost 6 trillion rubles, about 13.6% of GDP. TARP was down about 7%. You add to that Obama's 7.6%. We're running now a little bit over this, but initially that was the world's strongest reaction. And Europe is complaining about the size of the U.S. reaction now. The Russian Central Bank kept working to defend the ruble and allow for a slow depreciation, keep its value relatively strong. This actually started in late September, and that's the seven times in 2008, and it kept going into 2009. The downside of their attempt to maintain the price of the ruble was the repurchase rate for central bank money went up to 11%, and that tightened the screws even more on non-protected small businesses, the kind that tend to employ foreigners and visiting labor. Okay. Despite that, the recession deepened. We're through the second phase. Medvedev was very clear about it in February 15th fireside chat. You can see industrial production went down dramatically, as did investment. Car production virtually stopped in January. Now, some of that was the New Year's break, but this is 80% off of the year before, which had also had a very hefty New Year's break. Interfirm credit market virtually collapsed because nobody places debt at 80% interest. Construction ceased. Unemployment went up to 7.7%, 8.5% in February. In fact, they just announced it's over 9.5% as of March, sort of the March unemployment rate. A number of economists were expecting over 10% before things settled down. Wage arrears have expanded dramatically. There's still only about 550,000 with wage arrears. Interestingly, it used to be the government that was in wage arrears. Now it is largely manufacturing industries, обрабатывающие, as they call them, that have, I think it was 8.75 trillion rubles in wage arrears. No, 8.75, I should look that up so that I get the comma in the right place. But in any case, I think it is 8.5 trillion rubles that are now in arrears. And there is still $140 billion worth of debt that needs to be serviced. Their forex reserves had dropped defending the ruble, but they were still fairly substantial. Okay, now, what is this third stage response? Well, begins with recognizing the severity and persistence of the crisis. It's not going to happen. Shuvalov says that no more bailouts of oligarchs, basically. We don't have the funds. And he'd already hit his favorite ones, or they'd already subsidized their favorite ones before this. You have an emphasis on administrative reform to increase government efficiency as the government is taking on more of the economy. There's a focus on the key industries with increasing state control over finance. There's the thought that about at least 150 banks are going to disappear. Substantial new support was provided to the three key state banks that they could use to maintain the critical sectors in the economy. There were 295 critical firms that were indicated needing support, 1,200 defense firms, and it was announced that we're not going to prevent foreigners from taking control of assets as long as they stay within the 5% or the 20% or the 25% limits that were in the May 5th, 2008 law, which declared as critical most things you can imagine, including forest husbandry and fishing. Okay. A new state budget, much more realistic, even though it has a very optimistic 2.2 drop in GDP. The drop in GDP in the first quarter relative to the first quarter of a year ago is already over 7.5%. So they're going to have a real recovery in the later part of the year if they're going to get anywhere near that. Again, they focused on supporting specific industries and firms, reducing foreign indebtedness. They have actually been reducing that amount. It went up very dramatically, briefly at the beginning of the crisis. It's now been coming down again. Rebuilding their forex earnings. They have held steady despite some $30 billion in capital flight. They are, however, delaying infrastructures and structural reforms. It's sort of the opposite direction from bailouts in the West. which focus on build infrastructure, what's shovel ready, let's employ people that way. Here the focus is not on employing anybody. It's maintaining productive enterprises that the state, well, production enterprises, productive or otherwise, the state considers critical for its interests, keeping them alive. So the consequences, to finish up, negative growth in 2009, clearly. They expect a recovery in 2010, actually beginning in the fourth quarter. Independent economists are rather more sanguine about that. It is going to probably be negative well into 2010. And indeed, Kudrin and Klipach most recently are worried that the reserve fund is going to be emptied before the end of 2010, and the part of the welfare fund will have to go just for maintaining these support programs. So if they don't get a recovery in 2010, there is a very serious problem looming. Export earnings are dropping dramatically. Despite the stabilization of the oil price, other metals have not gone up, and oil at $40 a barrel is not good for the Russian economy. It means also gas is no longer $400 a thousand cubic meters, but it's dropped to 280 now in the contracts and will probably go below 200 if this lasts through the year. We have a slowdown in all development programs. Even the priority Olympstroy is taking a 10% cut, but then Gazprom very magnanimously announced that it was voluntarily giving $20 million to it this year. Compensate for that. Liberal reform, and this is coming to the true end, is fairly clearly dead, even though sort of the rise in some prices to consumers, Putin just indicated about a week ago, will go forward. But the structural reforms that were supposed to come with that are not going forward. Various mechanisms of hierarchical control over the economy are being strengthened. We have a new presidential council to strengthen the financial vertical that was set up in late October. The banks are taking on a very strong transmission belt role for exercising government influence over industrial and other productive activities, state control of credit. Finansovy Gosplan is on the boards. We have a consolidation of industry and finance. Non-state activity is still being squeezed. Anything that is not in a favored firm or a favored sector has to really scramble. Now, the flexibility of Russian labor markets makes the survival of those companies somewhat more likely than it would be in a more constrained environment, but it bodes ill for those who are employed there. They are now still open to foreign financial investment, as long as it doesn't try and take any equity control. And the most favorable thing that happened in the last month and a half was the announcement of the U.S. recovery program, because that, you throw cumulatively some $3 trillion out there, that led to a drop in the price of the dollar and a dramatic rise from the low 30s up to over $40 per barrel in oil. And that has been what has stabilized the Russian economy momentarily.
Okay, thank you. That was very, very comprehensive. And in the Q&A, we'll try and draw out what's the political economy and what the way that this will affect migration scene. Rachel, that sets the stage for you.
Well, thank you very much. Human Rights Watch has embarked on a two-year project on labor migration that has, and we did this because in Central Eurasia, and we've done this because there are so many millions of people on the move in Central Eurasia in search of, for a variety of reasons, but primarily because they're seeking a better life, they're seeking better wages, they're seeking some kind of sustainable income. And we thought that it was a very important time to start looking at the rights implications of this, fantastic number of people on the move. And we decided to focus on Russia first, but so my presentation today is about the report that we released in February on Russia. And while currently we continue to follow up on Russia. In fact, one of the leaders of this labor migration project is in Russia right now doing follow-up with Russian government structures and companies, et cetera. We've also parallelly started research on Kazakhstan. But we did this. I think we decided to focus on Russia first and foremost for reasons that I think are probably quite obvious. Russia has the second largest migrant population in the world, second only to the United States, and an enormous number of labor migrants in Russia. The estimates there's an enormous number of labor migrants in Russia. The estimates vary. If you listen to the Federal Migration Service, that's between 7 and 9 million. If you talk to experts at the Academy of Sciences, they'll say between 3 and 4 million, and 80% of these are labor migrants. And we've focused on labor migration involving labor migrants from former Soviet Union countries, and we've done this for two reasons. First, because they make up 80% of Russia's labor migrant population. And also because of the special non-visa regime that most countries of the former Soviet Union share with Russia. This creates a unique situation. I think because in most situations where a country has a labor migrant population, they're generally coming from countries with the labor migrants are generally coming from countries with poorer economies where there is, you know, poverty and unemployment. With these countries, there is typically a visa regime precisely for those reasons. Whereas in Russia, it's the opposite. In Russia, you have a no-visa regime with countries whose economies are vastly smaller and vastly poorer than Russia. This is also a really important time to look at labor migration in Russia for a couple of reasons. First, we started this work at a time when Russia had just started to, we conceptualized this work at a time when Russia had started to relax its migration regime. And we can talk about this in question and answer. There was a reforms that went into effect in 2007 that made it easier for migrants to regularize their stay in Russia, through the registration system. And also reforms that made it easier for labor migrants to get slightly easier for labor migrants to get work permits. Also, it's an important time because we started this project at a time when Russia was in, as Professor Erickson has said, in the time of great economic boom, labor migrants, according to some experts, contributed to up to, I mean, Professor Erickson, tell me if I'm wrong, but contributed to up to 9% of GDP. That was in times of boom. Now we're in time of bust, and I think that one of the first questions that we got when the bust started happening, and there was increasing violence against visible, migrants in Russia was, well, with the economic bust, doesn't this mean that all the labor migrants are going to go home? There won't be any more problems with labor migrants. It's just the opposite. Because the countries from which that make up the greatest sender, the sender labor migrant population to Russia, because their economies are in much worse shape, you will still have a continuous flow of labor migrants to Russia. You might have more, you might have less, but you will still have labor migrants coming. And if anything, I would think that the economic crisis puts them in an even more vulnerable situation. Labor migrants are especially, have a special kind of vulnerability in Russia because, as I said before, they're driven. Their motivation to go to Russia is they're driven by poverty and unemployment in their home countries. They are therefore highly vulnerable to exploitation in Russia. Also, they're especially vulnerable because of the kind of growing dynamic of xenophobia in Russia, both officially and officially and unofficially. Yes, we did see a relaxation of Russia's migration rules, which was very progressive. But at the same time, you also see a certain xenophobic impulse in a number of public statements by Russian officials. And also, we've seen. A rise in xenophobic violence, and sometimes in quite grotesque acts of violence against labor migrants. Our work focused on the construction sector, And we focus on the construction sector in Russia because 40% of labor migrants in Russia are in the construction sector, and because the construction sector is one of the most unregulated industries that you can think of, and so it's highly, highly unregulated. And the third reason is because the construction boom, the economic boom, really fueled a lot of construction, and it was drawing more and more labor migrants. So the construction sector, we thought, was a very important sector to look at. And like I said, I mean, in times of boom, the construction sector drew more and more labor migrants. It was important to look at it. And in times of bust, I think it's equally important, because labor migrants have nothing to return to, and it just means that they're even more vulnerable to exploitation. And let me tell you a little bit about the research. First, I want to acknowledge here Maria Lisitsina, Masha Lisitsina, who is here with us today, who is Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher who engaged in almost all the research for this report. And I'm speaking now, but she is available, obviously, to answer questions. And the way we did the research, Masha, together with Jane Buchanan, who is now in Russia, we interviewed about 150 labor migrants. We interviewed them in Russia in about traveling to about five different regions to talk to them. We went to 9 different towns and villages in Tajikistan and 9 different towns and villages in Kyrgyzstan. Most of the workers we interviewed were, you know, because it was the construction sector, most of them were from countries of Central Asia. There is a large number of Ukrainian and Belarusians and Moldovans also who work in Azerbaijanis who work in construction. We found that some of those, particularly the Ukrainian and the Belarusian communities, were a bit elusive for us to access, but we did get a couple of interviews. The people who we interviewed represented people who had worked in a total of 49 different towns, cities, and other locations throughout Russia. And we found a wide range of abuses, a wide spectrum of abuses ranging from trafficking into forced labor, which we found about 5 cases, to just the absolutely pervasive failure by employers to provide labor contracts to labor migrants. And I just want to also say that not everybody told about exploitation. Not every single person we interviewed told a horror story. Some people had neutral stories to tell. Some people had positive stories to tell. But I think the overwhelming majority of people we interviewed talked about exploitation. And like I said, the most egregious forms were trafficking into forced labor. We documented 5 cases, but we believe, and I think there are statistics that show that it's actually more pervasive than that, or more prevalent than that. We looked at cases. We had a number of people talk about how even though they weren't trafficked, their passports were confiscated by their employers, very much limiting their ability. You know what it's like in Russia. You can't go anywhere without your passport because if you get picked up by the police, all kinds of terrible things can happen to you. It really confines your movements. As I said, across the board, failure to provide contracts, and across the board, very pervasive failure to put either pay wages, to pay promised wages, to pay wages on time. Very common also was the practice of deductions, unlawful deductions from wages, which means that in some cases, the failure to pay wages meant that people just get desperate. They wonder, they're paid either, seasonally or by the month or every 2 months. And so you find that some people would just continue to work at their construction sites. They don't know when they're going to get paid, but they'll just continue to work because they're just hoping that someday they'll get paid. We found a number of incidents where people worked in, I mean, it's the construction sector after all, and it's highly unregulated, and there are some very, very unsafe conditions. And we interviewed a number of people who talked about very unsafe conditions and people who had actually been badly injured on the job. We also looked at issues that weren't necessarily related to the labor experience. Police violence, police extortion, also violence on the part of the employers. And we also looked at the migration regime itself. But the reason why we focused on the labor violations because we felt that that was an issue that other rights organizations weren't focusing on. I think there's been a lot of really excellent work done on the problems with Russia's migration regime and its limitations, but this was the first time really that anybody had looked at labor violations and in combination with migration regime problems. Like I said, the people, labor migrants in Russia are especially vulnerable, but even though they enter legally, they enter Russia legally because this particular pool of labor migrants don't need visas. But the failure by their employers to provide a contract means that, or to even notify the authorities, as the employers are obliged to do, notify the authorities that they have migrants working for them, foreign migrants working for them, means that even though you entered the country legally, even though you obtained a work permit, your work permit expires after 90 days if you don't have a standard Russian labor contract, a трудовой договор. If you don't have that, your work permit expires and you're illegal. So in other words, even though the process has been simplified, there's kind of a new trapdoor, and the whole kind of irregularizing of labor migrants falls with the employer rather than with the state. It's the employer's failure to provide the labor contract now that is the key to all the other, that's the key and I think the multiplier of vulnerability. So it means that without a labor contract, you have nowhere to turn to for redress, if you even have the courage to seek redress for the abuses that I just described. It means that because you, the labor migrant, are automatically scapegoated, right? You're the one who's illegal. If you try to get redress, if you try to complain, you're inhibited from doing so because you fear, rightfully, because you're scapegoated, that you will be fined, harassed, deported, and that's the end. And I think this is another key, the second problem is that the government agencies, the main government agency that investigates labor violations, the Labor Inspectorate, or Rostrud, won't investigate labor violations if in situations where labor relations haven't been proven, which means that the fact that the labor migrant worked for this construction firm, that can't be disputed in order for Rostrud to take up an investigation. And the standard way to prove labor relations is to have a labor contract. Otherwise, if Muhammedov goes to complain to Rostrud about about violations that he's experienced, Rostrud can go to the construction site and they'll say, he doesn't work for us. And Rostrud says, okay, we're finished. So there's really not an investigation. So in the absence, so this is why these are all the reasons why these violations are so pervasive. There's really no mechanism to hold employers accountable, employers and also intermediaries accountable. So as a result, labor migrants turn to very informal mechanisms to get their wages when they suffer from delayed payment of wages or failure to pay wages. And when I say informal, I really mean informal. I mean it can range from turning to NGOs and asking NGOs to intervene, and in some cases that's successful. NGOs like Fond Tajikistan. It can mean turning to diaspora groups, who will, you know, call the employer and say, no, postupaj po sovesti, you know, do the right thing, you know, be good. Or it can be really informal and people just turn to mafia structures, you know, to get their money, which means that they get half of their money because, of course, you have to pay the enforcer. Who's responsible for all of this? To a large degree, employers for sure are responsible for this kind of unlawful exploitation. Almost all the time, though, labor migrants in the construction sector don't know who their employers are. Because Professor Erickson, you could tell us more about this, but the construction industry is a web of contractors and subcontractors and subcontractors. Intermediaries play an important role in this kind of exploitation, but the intermediaries range broadly from formal employment agencies or recruitment agencies in sender countries. But, you know, only a small minority of labor migrants turn to these kinds of agencies in order to arrange for travel and employment in Russia. The vast majority of them have informal recruiters, informal intermediaries. But there are cases even of the formal agencies who are utterly exploitative, negligent, and unscrupulous. And there are a couple cases I can talk about in more detail in question and answer. Where do we go next? I think that one of the key I'd like to tell you about three sort of key recommendations that we have for as a result of this report, and where we'd like to go next in the advocacy. Even though there's private employment agencies and private employers who are kind of the main violators here, there is also a great kind of failure by the state to provide protection, and that's why one of the main recommendations we have for the Russian government is for RusTrud, for the Labor Inspection Service, to make clear that it will investigate and prosecute all labor violations, regardless of the labor migrants or regardless of the workers' migration or labor status. That they need to investigate, they need to do it proactively, and they need to do it vigorously. We also think that there's room for further simplifying, further liberalizing Russia's migration regime. And I can talk more about that during the discussion. The sending countries need to, one of the key recommendations we have for them is to do a better job of regulating the employment recruitment agencies. Like I said, there, even though only a small minority of labor migrants use them, they make promises that they don't keep, and they are for the most part completely unaccountable for that. And they have, in some cases, simply brought labor migrants to Russia and dumped them. This was one of the projects that Human Rights Watch did in Russia that was actually fairly constructively received by the Russian media and by the Russian authorities. I think the vice speaker of the Federation Council, which is the upper house of parliament, said it was a very important report and a very important piece of work and a very serious piece of work, and that they could have a constructive role to play in finding a solution to this problem. And I think that's something that we can really build on, and that's why we are doing more advocacy with RusTrud, with the Federal Migration Service, with the Duma. We're to look for more reform on the reform of the enforcement mechanisms for labor. Also, I think it's really important to start doing outreach to companies that either do or don't have corporate social responsibility programs, to get them to agree to adopt a code of conduct for adopt a code of conduct for the role of, you know, for the treatment of workers, including migrant workers in the construction sector. We can talk more about how that can actually be done, but I think it's especially important to be done now with Sochi looming. And even though Sochi's budget has been cut, there is still going to be an Olympics in Sochi, and there's going to be an enormous amount of construction for those Olympics. And I would be surprised if it didn't involve an enormous amount of migrant labor. So it's especially important to start this now. To get this kind of commitment now, and I think it's also important to see more cooperation between NGOs working on labor migration and lawyers who have expertise in labor law. I talked about how Russ Trude won't investigate labor violations unless there's essentially, de facto, unless there's a labor contract. Well, civic assistance. A very, very important NGO in Russia who's working on this issue, actually successfully challenged this in court. They represented a labor migrant, I think from Tajikistan? No. From Uzbekistan, who had the courage to complain about, failure to pay wages, right? And Russ Trude refused to investigate the case. They investigated the case and they said, oh, well, you know, we're finished because there's no labor contract here. And civic assistance took them to court, and the court found that Russ Trude's failure to fully investigate this constituted failure to act. And I think that's a very important, I mean, that should be a landmark case. There should be more cases like it. So I think that there's really more room there to cooperate with, to encourage cooperation with labor lawyers. I think I'll finish up there.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel. I also want to point out that if you haven't seen the report, there's one of the very good things that Human Rights Watch does to supplement their work is they have excellent documentary photography. And I see somebody, we have a colleague here. Some very striking images here. Which
I have them on a flash disk, but I didn't want to disturb the...
Speaking of which, I like sitting in the dark, but now that we've had the... switch. Do you have it on a?
It's on a power. The images are on a PowerPoint.
If you want to fiddle with it while.
No, maybe not.
Michael speaks. We can try. But otherwise, Michael, why don't we give you the floor?
Thank you, Anthony. And I want to thank Professor Erickson and Rachel for their presentations, and particularly thanks to Human Rights Watch for this really very, very interesting and very timely and important report, which really does lay out the extreme difficulties, I think, that many migrants from Central Asia do face in Russia. The simple fact is that despite these great difficulties, migration to other parts of Central Asia, to Kazakhstan, for example, but in particular to Russia, has been hugely important for Central Asia in general, certainly for Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, and for Tajikistan in particular. And when you realize that Tajikistan is a country where 53% of the population still lives below the poverty line, where you have a very, very large and growing population consisting and a very young population, it's understandable the very considerable push factors that are behind migration to Russia for work. One of the problems with looking at migration in Tajikistan is that nobody really has a very definitive, clear picture of exactly the numbers that we're talking about, either in terms of actual migrants or in terms of the numbers. Everyone agrees that it's significant, both in terms of people who go and the money that they send back, but there are widely varying estimates of exactly how big it is. So, but what I'd like to do, and I'll try to keep myself very brief to allow as much time as possible for discussion, is just hit a few points of how the current situation in Russia, as we've seen presented, might affect Tajikistan. There, based on a recent trip that I had about a month ago to Tajikistan, which I had the chance to meet with obviously our colleagues at our foundation there, also representatives from the NGO sector, from the international sector, IFIs, donors, embassies, and also a few government officials as well. So try to give a picture of what is on what people are saying, at least what I was able to hear there, and what this all might mean for the country as a whole. So as I said, it's difficult to get a definitive picture. First of all, of how many people we're talking, what the size of migration is. On the low end, what I heard from many officials in Tajikistan was around 200,000 to 300,000 people, which I think is much, much lower than the actual picture. Colleagues at our foundation have told me that they were told by Russian officials that the number of officially legally registered Tajiks in Russia right now is around 1.3 million, in fact, of around 8,000 of which are permanent residents. So we're talking 1.3 million people there temporarily, legally, and this is not counting whoever might be there illegally. So obviously anecdotal evidence suggests that the numbers are, that is probably towards the much larger end of the spectrum. I think anyone who's been to Tajikistan and has traveled around the country, particularly outside of the winter months, and has seen who's working in the cotton fields, for example, it's exclusively women and children. There are entire villages and regions where there are practically no men whatsoever to be found between the ages of 16 and 60 and up. The simple fact being that they're all in Russia, largely in Russia. There are also varying estimates about how much money is actually coming back. Traditionally, it seems to have there are estimates that it's around 20 to 50% of the GDP of the country. So whatever amount you talk about, whether you say it's $1 billion, $2 billion. It's quite significant and extremely important. Again, given the massive poverty and unemployment in the country, this has been a lifeline in a couple of very important ways. First of all, obviously, in terms of direct financial support to families living in the country, but also in a sense that's provided a kind of a social safety valve, where you have hundreds and thousands, certainly, and perhaps upwards of a million, mostly men, mostly young, who would otherwise be in the country unemployed. It also has played a very important role, I think, in keeping social tensions at a low level. Now, the question is, given the rather dire straits of the Russian economy, what to expect? And this is where things get, again, very, very, very tricky and very controversial, but I'll just sort of go through some of the things that I've heard that point to a rather, I think, on the whole, alarming picture. Remittances are still coming. People are still going abroad to work. And in fact, most people that I spoke to were still expecting a net outflow of people from Tajikistan in 2009. And the overall numbers, the actual number of transactions occurring of money being sent through banks, again, based on people in the banking sector that I spoke to, the actual number seems to be about the same of transactions. Now, the concerning thing, however, is that the value of these transactions is considerably less. In fact, one banking official that I spoke to told me that the value of remittances for February 2009 were actually 20% of what they were in February 2008. So the number of transactions is still occurring. The amount of money being sent back is much, much less than it was previously. What this would imply is that people, at the moment at least, appear to be staying and finding other work, but simply receiving much, much less, and consequently having much less money available to send back. The scenario of hundreds of thousands or more of people suddenly flooding back into the country, in Tajikistan or similarly in Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan, does not seem to be happening yet. But I add the word yet, and nobody quite knows what to expect. Traditionally, many migrants do come back to their home countries in winter anyway. And the big question now is, now that spring is coming, how many will return to Russia? So among many people that I spoke to, there was a sense of, well, let's wait and see. Let's not panic. Let's wait and see what happens when spring comes. And that will be the moment we'll have a better picture of whether or not people are still going or whether or not people will be staying. There are anecdotal accounts about trains, buses, planes, which used to be packed, actually being somewhat less so than they have in the past, or in some cases empty. But again, I should stress these are anecdotal accounts only, and no one really seems to have a very definite numbers or figures. Now, this, of course, makes it tricky when it comes to deciding what to do and how to tackle the situation. And among officials that I spoke to, I heard a number of different reactions, but on the whole, a certain rather interesting, intriguing lack of concern. First of all, intriguing, let's call it that. First of all, there's some skepticism about the higher figures of the number of migrants. Many insist that actually, no, the numbers are much, much lower. It's a couple of hundred thousand. Even if they do return, we can absorb them into the economy. It's no big problem. What I was told, there was initially, at least when the crisis began to break, a certain sense among the government of Tajikistan that this really wasn't their problem. Because their banking sector, so the argument went, was pretty much isolated from the international monetary system, and that what was happening to banks and the financial sector and so on really didn't mean very much for Tajikistan. Well, I think that picture has been adjusted somewhat. Many banks in Tajikistan, of course, as is the case elsewhere in Central Asia and Kyrgyzstan, for example, rely on financing from banks in Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan has had problems of its own even before the global financial crisis hit. So even that assumption that the banking sector would somehow be protected from all of this hasn't quite borne out. One official that I said that I spoke to insisted that all is well, that there's a plan in place, there's a reserve fund of about $20 to $30 million, which he estimates would be perfectly adequate to provide a couple of hundred thousand jobs paying around $100 or so a month. So, you know, all was in readiness to absorb returning migrants. Some of the international members of the international community I spoke to actually said, well, the actual amount is more likely to be around $30 a month or so, and it's not likely that many people will be willing to take a job like this. So there's perhaps also feeding into the at least a visible lack of concern, as I think there's a certain sense growing in Tajikistan now that with the shift of focus on the part of the United States towards Afghanistan, that Tajikistan will simply now become, to borrow a phrase, too big to fail, and that as bad as things might get, the West is simply too interested in maintaining stability in Tajikistan to allow things to fall apart. So that even if we do have hundreds of thousands coming back, there's a certain, I think, confidence. Now, whether or not this is justified is another question, but a certain confidence that Tajikistan can rely on massive international aid given its increasing geopolitical role. That all having been said, I think there is still some concern at high levels of the government in Tajikistan, but a great deal of uncertainty of how to proceed and a certain lack of willingness, of course, to acknowledge that things could get quite serious and things could actually potentially get bad and lead to very serious social tensions. So there's a reluctance to even broach this possibility, which I think is also hampering the government's making any sort of serious comprehensive contingency planning. Which seems to be the case right now. For their part, the donors and the IFIs and embassies with whom I spoke, the mood seems to range from a general sort of pessimism to out-and-out panic about what this could all, in fact, mean for Tajikistan. And I sensed a very strong concern that the government of Tajikistan was simply not planning and had no strategic plan in place to deal with a very potentially serious social and economic crisis. That having been said, it does seem to be the case that to a certain extent some of the official confidence in Tajikistan that of their new importance is borne out. A number of donors, in fact, are lining up, I think, including the World Bank, the ADB, the European Union, if I'm not mistaken, and IMF, to give about $200 million in direct budget support in 2009. So despite all of the misgivings, despite all of the concerns, I think there is still a feeling that the perhaps the increasing geopolitical role of Tajikistan might overshadow reservations or even conditionality on much of this aid. What to expect? What does all of this mean for Tajikistan? What are the possible implications? Well, I'm sure many of you are familiar with a recent report by the International Crisis Group, which paints a very troubling picture and quite alarming picture of a government of a country that is, in many ways, heading quite rapidly towards collapse. I would say that certainly, if there is not more attention paid and if there is not more of a willingness on the part of the government to grapple with this problem, to address this problem, to put in place some kind of contingency plan, first of all, to acknowledge that things could get quite serious. There seems to be a reluctance even to go that far. That the potential is quite real, perhaps not for collapse. I think we're still a little bit, we've got quite a ways to go before things get to that level. But certainly for very markedly increased tension in the country. The government was quite lucky this year, I think, with the relatively mild winter. It managed to avoid the near humanitarian disaster of the previous year, when much of the country, including Dushanbe, which is almost unheard of, was without electricity for a very long period of time. They caught a break this time around. I think fortunately we're able to avoid any serious tensions. Now, there's no guarantee that they'll be so lucky the next time around. So I think there are those within the government who do recognize the need for taking serious action and for making some serious contingency plans. I think there are many in the donor community who also see this and are quite willing to work with the government towards doing this. While simply waiting for the government, though, to take that first step to present them something that they can begin to work with. In terms of the long-term implications for stability in the country, again, I think that the International Crisis Group report was quite accurate in pointing out the very serious and severe tensions that a prolonged economic crisis could bring to the country. Now, the government has I think, relied for a long time on the memory of the very terrible civil war of 92 to 97 to keep any potential unrest in line. And I think that to a very large extent, they've been right to do so. The people do still have the memory of this event, and it does very much so make them willing to tolerate a certain degree of deprivation as long as there is continued peace in the country. Now, the question is, though, how long is this particular approach going to be sustainable, particularly with a very young population for whom the war is simply not part of their active memory. So the situation is potentially quite serious. But again, though, much depends on what happens in Russia, and much depends on whether or not, in fact, large numbers of migrants do begin to return home. Right now, it seems like that is not happening, that they are finding other employment, less gainfully. But given the fact that there are simply no alternatives back in Tajikistan, most of them seem to be, so far at least, preferring to stay, to deal with receiving less money, to deal with the kinds of conditions that are detailed in the Human Rights Report, Human Rights Watch report, simply in the absence of other alternatives. Now, whether or not this will remain to be the case is something that we'll have to wait and see. So I think with that, I'll stop and just leave more time for questions and comments.
Okay, well, thanks to all the speakers again. Is the lighting good for discussion? We don't need to change it. Okay. I took a lot of notes and have questions, but I follow this issue probably pretty regularly, and I wanted to give for the opportunity audience to have questions that they would like to open up with.
I have a question about Tajikistan. When you have a massive outflow of that order of a very particular group, males between, I don't know, 18 and 45 or so, what are the social consequences of this? A friend of mine has found that in some parts of Tajikistan, birth rates have dropped significantly. And when he asked local officials about it, he said, well, this is a good thing. This is a sign of social development and progress. But he felt that it was very much due to the absence of males. And I'm the last person in the world to suggest that, you know, communities and families can't, you know, need to have a man there, you know, to do well. But when you just the scope and the scale of this, and what is the impact of that right now and in the near future?
Thanks. Well, it affects, it has a number of different effects, obviously. On demographics, you know, that's not really my specialty so much. So, obviously, there's a certain effect. But keep in mind that, you know, men often do go back and forth. Sometimes, in fact, men will have families in both countries. They'll leave families behind in Tajikistan, move to Russia, and start up new families there, which also has consequences of its own. Needless to say, what often happens is that the ones who are, I think, most directly affected by this are the women. Who are left behind, or suddenly find themselves in charge of families, in effect. In some cases, the husband continues to support them. In other cases, he does not. Quite often what happens is the money that is sent back by the husband goes not to the wife, but to the mother-in-law, who ultimately herself decides how it's to be distributed. So what's happening in Tajikistan is, I think, a very marked increase in the number of female-headed households. Now, this was something that started actually after the Civil War, because many of the victims of the Civil War were, in fact, most were men, and it's become exacerbated now by the issue of labor migration. So, and this has both positive and negative effects. On the one hand, it means that women now have, in some cases, looking at on the bright side, perhaps have a degree of responsibility and authority in the family that they may not have had before, particularly if now they suddenly become the wage earners, which is happening in many cases. On the other hand, it also adds to increased pressures put upon them, because now very often women sometimes are responsible for taking care of not only their own children, but also the relatives of the husband, who again may or may not be still sending money back. So it creates opportunities in some ways, but also creates a whole series of new kinds of pressures and responsibilities for women, and in many ways puts them in a position which is still not fully, I think, appreciated in many parts of Tajikistan. The idea of a woman being actually in charge of resources and in charge of determining what gets spent for on what and who gets how much, it actually creates very serious strains within families. So, I mean, that's just one example. I mean, I think the social consequences, I think, can be many. So, as with so many things, it's a double-edged sword. It's also widely thought that one vector for the spread of sexually transmitted diseases within Tajikistan is also through labor migrants going back and forth between Tajikistan and Russia. So, with the economic benefits that it's provided traditionally, and they've been huge, I think there's simply no way that many families would have survived otherwise. It comes with quite serious social consequences as well.
Making use of Rick's other talents besides as an economist right now, but I think it looks like.
Would you like to say something about it as it goes through?
No, or? They're just, these are images from construction sites, a couple of construction sites in Russia, and also from in Tajikistan, from villages.
Some more questions? Faisal? Oh. Go ahead, you go first.
I actually have two questions. One is to... On?
Yeah, just introduce yourself.
Oh, hi, my name is Dasha. I work at the OSI. One of my questions, when you talk about safety requirements on construction...
You have to speak into the microphone.
When you talk about safety and injuries in construction sites, and my question is about cases when the injuries are sort of ongoing. For instance, when people work with asbestos or lead, and the consequences of that, if you could talk about that, if you came across such cases in your research. And maybe it's a question to Masha. And the second question is to Michael. Mm-hmm. When you talked about money transfers and banking, do you talk about like regular banking or like MoneyGram or Western Union? And is there possible to estimate the cash flow?
Most of the workplace safety aspects that we looked at were directly related to construction accidents. We haven't started to look at the long-term effects of exposure to chemicals, lead, things like that. But there were I'm not saying that they're not there. I'm just saying that wasn't really covered, I think, in the scope of this report. We looked at mostly accidents as a result of extremely shoddy or non-existent safety conditions. Masha, is there anything to add to that?
We also looked at it as a general situation, and again, coming back to labor contract, if you don't have a contract, you don't have access to state insurance that it's mandatory normally for all workers. So again, we documented the most egregious accidents, and everything else was more the systemic issues.
With regard to money transfers, I mean, you've identified a big part of the problem in figuring out exactly how much is coming back. What actually goes through the bank through formal transfer mechanisms, Western Union and all these others, and through the banks? I don't have the exact number right with me, but I think it's been around, the last estimate I heard was that it was around $1 billion for 2007. That's just through the banks. Now, nobody knows how much is going back other ways, and I'm sure lots of it is just being carried back, being transported back. So that's what makes it so difficult to know exactly the size. For estimates that I've heard for what's coming back in other ways generally seem to point to it being about a comparable amount. So maybe about half is going through the banks, half being carried back in other ways. But the simple fact is nobody really knows, which is what makes it so difficult to get a very clear picture of exactly, you know, what this is going to mean for Tajikistan, aside from saying, well, it's really big.
You given an estimate, or maybe Rick knows, the size of the state budget, and, you know, what percentage of fiscal revenues that remittance would represent.
Right. I mean, GDP is around $4 billion. I think the budget is around $500,000. $500 million to $1 billion. I don't remember the exact number. Maybe Rachel has it.
According to Tajik official statistics, that remittances accounted for 37% of GDP.
Okay.
That's the official story. And,
That's $1.4 billion.
And that's pretty, it's a lot more than Uzbekistan. It's more than twice the reliance of Uzbekistan on remittances. Uzbek economy, I think, is 12% remittances, GDP, and Kyrgyz, it's about 27%. Ukraine, actually, I think you find the dollar numbers are larger, but the percent of the Ukraine economy is smaller, so it's something like 0.8% of the Ukrainian economy, but it's an enormous amount of money.
Yeah, I guess it depends what when you say the economy, and whether
it's
society, and also whether we measure it as a kind of percentage of budget, a state budget, or economy, and I'm not sure which is the most meaningful.
Sure, the economy, because the state budget has a lot of transferring in it that doesn't add.
Good. Some more questions. Faisal.
Faisal Bari, OSI. Actually, two or three comments. The first one on the Russian economy, it seems that I mean, my background is Pakistan, so it looks like a very healthy economy to me. I mean, with such a low debt as a whole, even if they run out of reserves, they'll be able to borrow quite significantly from the international community. And so going through the next 2-3 years on the back of very hefty reserves in terms of resources, even though their current price might be low, might not be that big of an issue. In terms of sustaining the economy and looking at the future, the 5, 10, whatever number of years. In terms of how the Russian sort of construction sector treats migrant versus, say, a local laborer, I haven't looked at the report, but is there a comparison with the local laborer to see if there are stark differences? Because, I mean, if the entire sector is informal, as in, say, Pakistan, then whether you're an Afghan worker or a Pakistani worker, both of them get treated very badly. Whereas if you're in UAE, say, and you're a local versus an immigrant worker, the the treatment is very different, or in the United States for that matter, the issue is very different. But and the third point is, if these remittances are so very important for these economies, and they are also important for some other economies in other regions, again, Pakistan being one of them, I'm a little surprised also that so far we haven't yet attempted to create some notion of an international treaty on migrant rights or immigrant rights, etc. Or is there any such sort of movement that you might be very aware of that is sort of coalescing around these ideas to make for much better protection? Because you know, trade is very clearly identified as a sector that is looked at very, very closely, but labor and migration still tends to be underdeveloped in those terms.
Well, on the first one, not so much the second. Russia indeed could borrow for a substantial period if it were willing to. One of Putin's primary claims to fame is that he got out from under the thumb of the IMF. It's a very large matter of pride that they not become dependent on foreign financial capital. So that's something of a barrier to going that route. They do have enough funds to go through 2010 without hitting anything substantial. However, if the prices of resources do not recover, they will be burned through. They still have a lot of foreign exchange that you could burn through for another year. But at that point, what do you do? I mean, they have these major development projects. They've created a dozen new corporations, as they call them, to bring these about, like Rosnanotech, to develop nanotechnologies and their applications that are now in a funding hiatus while Russia gets over this. And they are projects that are not apt to yield any kind of benefit, if they ever do, for at least half a decade. And they can't afford that period, at least while maintaining their pretense to a major world role, ability to help finance other countries, buy bases here, there, and elsewhere, compete with the Chinese over resource development in Central Asia.
Regarding your question about, should I continue?
Go ahead.
Your question about the comparative position of labor migrants and Russian workers, who also might be internal migrants. It's an excellent question. It's one we thought a lot about. For methodological reasons, we didn't do a comparative study. We needed to keep this report rather focused, but I think it's pretty clear, for the reasons that you said, that because the construction industry is wildly unregulated, that we could, it's reasonable to think that Russian workers who work in construction are exposed to some of the same abuses that labor migrants endure. But I think it's important to emphasize labor migrants have a special kind of vulnerability to these abuses, because a Russian worker has other options. There is still the rest of the Russian economy to turn to. The labor migrants came to Russia because they're desperate, and it's a special kind of exploitation when you're exploiting someone because you know they're when you exploit someone's utter desperation because you know that he's got nowhere else to turn. The second thing is that a foreign labor migrant's status, as I said before, hinges on his ability to have a labor contract. So if a Russian worker doesn't have a labor contract, the worker is not the violator. It's the employer. The onus is almost completely on the employer. Whereas if the labor migrant doesn't have an employment contract, the likelihood that the employer is going to be prosecuted is very low, and the likelihood that the labor migrant will endure financial consequences and administrative consequences and be deported is very high. And then there are other elements of vulnerability. So I think yes, the conditions are probably lousy for everybody, but I think that there's an accentuated vulnerability of labor migrants to that kind of exploitation. And your other question, Yeah. Well, there is the International Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Their Families. I think one of the key elements of which says that migrant workers everywhere have rights regardless of their contractual or migration status, regardless of whether they're regularized or irregular. Russia hasn't signed that convention yet. Neither, for that matter, has, I think, a single European Union or any Western country. None of them have. So it's a big problem. The Western countries aren't setting a very good example when they refrain from signing these and ratifying these kinds of conventions. But there are international mechanisms, and that's not the only one. There are certain protocols, ILO protocols that deal with migrant labor. Part of our advocacy involves encouraging and garnering, mobilizing support for Russia to sign the Labor Migrants Convention, but that's not where we started, because I think it's much more important right now to try to directly influence Russia. I think signing the Labor Migration Convention, I think, is probably a long way off.
I had a couple of questions for Rick and Rachel. At one point, Rachel, you started mentioning a statistic about your estimate of the economic value that labor migrants contribute to the Russian economy. I was wondering if you could restate that and then maybe have a dialogue with Rick about the significance, whether it's right and whether it's accurate. I think that the question behind the question is that one of the arguments that it has been thought might be effective to persuade Russia to treat these people better would be if they appreciated the contribution they make to the Russian economy and the Russian recovery. That was one question. The other question was, Rachel had made a statement about the upcoming Olympic Games, and I guess there's probably people are already forming a queue to put items on the agenda for Sochi, but to what extent are foreign companies, especially in this current environment where, say, there would be an interest, it seems, in the Russian government to throw construction jobs, Gossakazi, in the direction of Russian companies? I mean, to what extent is the international economy going to play a role at all right now in Olympstroy?
First, the figure of contribution of labor migrants to Russian GDP, the figure that we have, which comes from Iran, the Academy of Sciences, from one of their experts on labor migration, was 9%. I don't know, Rick, if you would dispute that.
It's not implausible.
But I think that what lies behind that figure is should also be an impressionistic. I mean, that should be an impressionistic appreciation for the fact that at least the construction boom, with 40% of Russia's labor migrants in construction, the construction boom, I think, is visibly fueled by migrant labor. You go anywhere in Russia and you look at a construction site, you see, the faces are all faces of people from other parts of the former Soviet Union. This is an enormous contribution, and I think that there are elements of the officialdom that recognize that. Certainly, I think you hear voices in the Federal Migration Service that recognize that migrant labor is an enormous contribution to the Russian economy, and that their push is to make it easier has been to make it easier for them to become regular, in other words, to become legal, to be legally registered, and I think there was a push for reasonable regulations in that regard. I think that there are also people in various political establishments in Russia that recognize, in the longer term, that with you know, Russia is often talked about as being in kind of a contracting demographic trajectory, that migrant, I mean, the figures vary depending on who you listen to. There are some more apocalyptic estimates than others, but the general, I think there's a general consensus that the Russian population has been contracting, and that what's keeping the economy very one of the elements that keeps the economy very dynamic is the inflow of labor migrants. So I think it's important to look both at the figure, but also the more impressionistically about what this contribution means. Do you want to talk more about that, or before we move on to Olimstroy and Basic Element?
Yeah, I think there are just a couple of things to keep in mind. One, 9% of GDP during a construction boom, when they largely employed construction, is quite plausible. There are about 11.5% of the labor force. So being underpaid, however, that was fueled by the tremendous construction boom that is virtually.
That's where that figure came from. So.
Yeah. So that it is apt in 2009 to be a substantially lower. Second thing. Another thing to remember about that is that since this workforce. Largely employable males. They don't. Is a direct labor force supplement.
And it seems that, according to what Michael was saying, at least impressionistically, that they're making a rational calculation of their interest, and that the even a diminished income in Russia is better than what opportunities they might have, such as no income in Tajikistan.
Actually, one of the advantages that the Russian economy has in dealing with a deep financial crisis in particular is that its labor markets are very flexible compared to Europe. And so the fact that these people are willing to work under virtually any conditions, doing almost anything, around at the bottom, as well as keep some flow of resources back to those countries.
I mean, staying on this for a moment, I mean, when we were in Russia in December, there was a sense from people who follow this in the capital and in Russian regions was that there would be a willingness to accept any legal or economic burden that were put on the migrants by them, just to retain jobs, and that this is, this is already taking place. And then I think there was also a sense that, that there would not be kind of competition from Russian workers for the type of positions that the Tajiks and Uzbeks and others from Central Asia are filling, which Russians wouldn't do. So the question is, how long can they hold on? Now, the other thing about the international engagement in Olimstroy, what do we know about that?
Well, there are two companies that are involved in they're responsible for pulling off Sochi, and one is Olimstroy, and the other is Basic Element, which is Deripaska's company. Olimstroy is responsible for all the infrastructure, roads, railways, things like that. I think the construction also of the stadia, the actual athletic sites. And Basic Element is hotels, shopping malls, all the other ancillary construction that'll be needed to support it, to support the Olympics. There are tenders going on all the time, and a lot of Russian companies are bidding and getting tenders. But I think that there is also, and it's very dynamic, so it's hard for me to tell you right now who's getting what contracts. I mean, Masha, do you have any update? Sorry? Nothing, yeah. I don't know. Yes. So a lot of it is Russian companies, but they're, I mean, it would be hard to imagine there not being a significant amount of foreign investment to pull off the construction in Sochi, or some foreign construction, some foreign investment. There are foreign firms that are bidding, and certainly, you see a couple. You know, there was a couple of weeks ago. I think it was the UK. Was it the UK or the German Chamber of Commerce? You know, had a conference. You know, opportunities in Sochi. I think we'll see a number of these, you know, governments promoting their country's companies for construction and for construction provision of services, contracts, etc. for Sochi. So I think it's going to play a role. I think first and foremost is going to be Russian companies.
Yeah. Seemed, Rick, when listening to your presentation of what was driving this Save the U.S. intervention, the largest intervention heretofore. The words that came to my mind as being the motives for this were kind of social control. That they wanted to. There was when we were there in December. There were stories and scenarios emerging. In fact, there was a journalist was kind of harassed for spreading. Scenarios of a kind of widespread worker unrest, and that. So I'm just wondering how do you understand the particular slant of the intervention in the Russian economy and the state when thinking about labor questions, and is there a point where the state could begin to make some difficult choices that might have an effect on whether Russian laborers are employed or whether labor migrants are employed. Indeed, one of the constraints that was announced by Putin in the November-December period was that there would be a kind of a quota imposed on the number of labor migrants that would be allowed to come into the country, which is a highly unenforceable in a populist type of policy statement to make.
Before you start, Rick, I didn't talk about the quota system in my presentation, but there is a quota system that's been in place. In fact, when Russia liberalized its migration regime in 2007, you know, the hand that giveth is the hand that taketh away. They simplified the process for registering and the process for obtaining a work permit, but at the same time they introduced quotas. But when they first introduced the quota system in 2007, it was a very liberal quota. It was something like 6 million work permits. That was 2007. 2008, the initial proposal, they reformed the system for creating the quota system. Instead of the federal government establishing a quota, what they did was they accepted proposals from each subject federacy, from each oblast, to say, well, how many permits for your oblast? And then the federal government set a cap of 1.8 million. So it went from 6 million in 2007 to 1.8 million, and then there was a general outcry about that, and the federal government relented, and so they created, like, well, say, oh, it's 1.8 million, but with a reserve, so up to 3.4 million. Sorry? 30% increase in the number of permits, but as a reserve system, right, Masha? And I just want to say a word about, if it's okay with you, Rick, about the quota system. I mean, you know, from perspective of international human rights law, there's nothing really to say about a quota system. You know, you can't say that quota systems are, you know, violate international, or contravene international human rights. But it should not. I think Russian experts have said that the quota system, while they have nothing against it, it should not negate the positive effects that the simplification of the migration rules had and the simplification of the work permit system had. But what you see with a quota system is that it introduced an enormous element of chaos into the lives of migrant workers and introduced an enormous, yet another opportunity for for corruption. I would just add that previously, workers who came to Russia from other former Soviet Union countries didn't need to get a work permit, or didn't fall under the quota system. Before 2007, there was a quota on work permits, but only for workers coming from outside the former Soviet Union. So now all of a sudden, there's another thing that chinovniki can control and extract bribes for. And it's on a first-come, first-served basis. The work permits are on a first-come, first-served basis. So if you have if you think that you can make sure that you're going to be the first in line by hiring an intermediary, even though you don't need an intermediary to get a work permit, you're supposed to be able to get one simply and within 10 days, you're going to hire an intermediary. You're going to pay whatever money you think you're going to have to pay to get the thing on time, which means who's getting all the work permits? The intermediaries. Who's the first in line? It's the intermediaries, who are also, you know, paying bribes to the Federal Migration Service. The problem gets exasperated and it becomes kind of a catch-22, because the more the intermediaries take up the space in line for the work permits, the more people are going to turn to intermediaries because they want to get their place in line. So that's my...
A natural result of rationing. Well, as for the objectives of the program, it seems to me that the primary objective of the rescue program is to keep control over... Central part of that is keeping labor from getting out of line. And so there's a lot of effort putting into controlling the kinds of information, how much you pay on the negative side of things before you step across a line. Crisis and so on. I think it will also naturally redound more heavily on those who are unprotected, the immigrant, than it will on the rest of labor. But all of Russian labor is suffering from the flexibility of the system. Aggravated by the fact that protection of industry is leading to various kinds of all of these constraints being put in effect, the industries they know and the activities they know, while basically ignoring how things sort out at the lowest level, because that's that gets thrown on the most vulnerable at that level.
Before wrapping up, I just wanted to mention that Kristen Whitehead and Cornelia Skrobner in particular are the people who keep our work on this subject going throughout the year. I don't know whether we covered everything, and if you had any questions you wanted to answer, Cornelius gives me the thumbs up. Did anyone on the panel have any final statements that they wanted to make? Okay, well then on that note, I'll bring it to a close, and please join me in thanking our panelists. I know we'll see Rachel and Michael here every day, practically. And Rick, I hope you'll come again soon. So thank you very much.